Hello, this is Rob Pearman, and you will have remembered that last month I was speaking with Mike Naber, the author of the two volumes on St Albans' own East End, and we explored what that title meant and how Leetville had developed over time, particularly from the late 19th century onwards. What I didn't ask Mike, and what I'm sort of almost saving for now, is really say, well, what on earth inspired you to start on this project? I mean, it is a big project, big books.
It is huge, and it's not until you get to the end of it you realise just how much of your life you've spent on it. I suppose as far as the research and the writing is concerned, that began when I was forced to take a retirement in, I think it was 2003. I therefore needed something to occupy my time, to keep my mind alert. But in fact, it had started almost decades before that, because I was beginning to research my family's own history. And I was particularly interested in my grandfather on my mother's side, because although I'm bereft of all knowledge, personal knowledge, of most of the men in my who could have influenced me in my life, both my grandfathers died before I was born. I didn't see a great deal of my father when I was growing up. So what my mother and my grandmother had told me about my grandfather had really inspired me to try and find out a little bit more beyond what they were able to tell me. Grandfather was a councillor on the city council. He had joined the very early Labour Party. And bearing in mind, this was a largely conservative council, I just wondered how on earth an upstart from the Labour Party, together with his great friend William Bond, who also served the Camp District as councillors, how they could ever cope. And indeed, when I looked at the council meeting minutes, they hardly got a look in, and any suggestion they made was fobbed off. And I give an example, just one example, in the 1920s. Bond and Simmons, and they wanted the council to embark on some schemes which would soak up employment in a time of heavy unemployment. Council saw no reason why they should do so. After all, the unemployed were largely those who rented homes, whereas their income came largely from those who paid rates and who weren't therefore unemployed. And it wasn't until in 1929 the government decided that they would provide grants to councils if they did engage with schemes of employment. And the council decided, well, they could have a bit of that. Now money was forthcoming. And at that time, St German's Farm, which is now part of Verulamium, was coming up for sale, and the council were concerned lest it go like all the other farms for house building. And they managed to strike a deal with Earl Verulam and acquired the farm. And in 1930, they began this scheme of turning it into a public park with lakes and so on. And Grandpa, I understand, was greatly honoured to have made it, at least one of his pet projects, going through. Unfortunately, he died the following year before the lake had a chance to fill, but at least I always felt that that was a practical memory of my grandfather. So it was he who really started me on the line of doing research.
But you also lived in the area.
He lived in the camp area.
You lived in the area as well?
I lived nearby on the Beaumonts estate, but it was all originally part of the same farm, Beaumonts Farm. So yes, he lived in the Camp District, coming from Wealdstone, but originally from Cornwall. He was a Cornishman. So he managed to serve the people who lived in along the Camp Road. I lived not very far from the Hatfield Road, a little bit further north.
Okay, so he was your inspiration, but if you live further out on Beaumonts, which itself has got perhaps a longer history than we're aware of, is that?
I think so, yes. People generally aren't aware of this because the houses tended to be a little bit more modern. We're talking about Beaumont Avenue, Beechwood Avenue, Woodland Drive, Heswood Drive. So these are entirely 20th century houses between the wars and, of course, post-war. The house where I was born and grew up was in Woodland Drive, the last one or two houses that were built in 1914 before the government ordered all house building to stop. My parents were very lucky to have married and bought that house just before the war started. The garden was actually in part of the former farmyard of Beaumont's farm. There were three farms in different periods of time. The farmhouse, which was just a little bit further down the road, and then next to that had previously been a Tudor farmhouse, and then a little bit south from that, on what is now the houses on the south side of Woodland Drive, was a moated manor house. But there is very little left of that, and although a brief survey was undertaken by what is now English Heritage, but wasn't called that at the beginning of the 20th century, they have now lost all the records of the surveys that they did.
But how far back do you think this all goes?
As far as we know, it goes back as far as at least the 1300s. But all the manorial records were also lost in a serious fire in the 1700s. So there's another loss of information which could have come down to us. We only know that the manor was part of the nunnery attached to St. Albans Abbey, and that was formed in 1240. So we presume that it went back to roughly that time. But who's to say? There might well have been a previous farm dwelling before that.
Okay, so if we look at Fleetville and we look at the east side, the east end of St. Albans today, we think of it as largely a 20th century development. You've taken us back and suggested that, well, told us that in fact it probably traces back to the 1300s or earlier. So that fits more into the picture of the general St. Albans and the surrounding villages, that it was a really pretty ancient development, even in those areas that we think of as modern housing.
We have really very little idea of how we bridge that gap between the early times and the more modern development, except that there are little things that come to mind. For example, all those people who live in Eaton Road who remember their houses being flooded because they're at the bottom of the hill can refer to a map of earlier times which actually shows a chalk stream running at the bottom. In fact, many streams flowed north to south towards the River Cone and across what is now the Hatfield Road. So I suppose the link between former times and more modern times is the Hatfield Road, which we know as a bustling, very congested route with goodness knows how many cars, 19 bus routes. But of course, at one time was just a lane linking it with Bishop's Hatfield, as Hatfield used to be called. And I'm sure that there was a need to link people with the Abbey at St. Albans with Bishop's Hatfield and longer routes out to Ely and so on.
So when you get the new estate that is on the British Aerospace site just at Hatfield, the end of the Hatfield Road, and they call it Bishop's Park.
Well, no, that was beyond there. What we would call Old Hatfield was called Bishop's Hatfield. Yes.
Okay.
But, yes, between there and St. Albans were goodness knows how many farms, none of them owned by Earl Verulam, but all in different ownerships.
Which is how you could then have this almost piecemeal development over.
That's right.
And quite rapid development, although it was piecemeal, it was happening very fast.
I think there had been very small developments, just the odd house, a little hamlet. Smallford, for example, the area we know as Smallford now, had a different name in the 19th century. It was just called Horseshoes. On one map, it's been referred to as the Four Wants, which is a very intriguing name. I'm still researching that one. It lay astride the Hatfield Road. We probably assume that it grew up as the Turnpike Road developed. And the Turnpike Road became necessary because in previous times it was partly impassable in places. The parishes refused to maintain it. If their parishioners didn't use it, why should they maintain it? And of course the idea of turnpike trusts came about in the late 18th century.
I was just thinking, and you mentioned Turnpike then, and you also mentioned it last time we were speaking, and I'm just really coming back to trying to understand what is the function of the Turnpike, and why there's one on Hatfield Road, but not on Sandpit Lane or other. I mean, you know, why was there one there?
The purpose of a turnpike road is to gather income for its continued upkeep and maintenance. And of course, the reason why you need a good road is to be able to transport goods from one place to another, and especially foods to markets. And of course, St Albans was very important from that point of view. You took your goods by the easiest route, and if a road was not maintained, it was more difficult to take goods through, so therefore people tried to avoid it. But then you get this question of, well, how much should I really have to pay in order to take my cattle or take my cart along this road? And we have no idea on this particular turnpike how much they paid, because it's another organisation where most of the records just do not survive. So we can only guess, and we can use information that turnpike trusts that have got their information surviving have provided us. People did try and avoid the turnpikes from time to time. And whether it was with the permission of the landowner or whether it was just because there were other little lanes available, we shall never know. But
were there other turnpikes around St Albans? I mean, could you not get to Harpenden without paying, as it were?
I have no doubt that people did. There are all sorts of things we're not supposed to do, but people do find a way of doing them. For the most part, it must have been reasonably successful, because the turnpike system lasted for getting on for a couple of hundred years. There were people we know who did avoid the turnpike. We referred in, when I was here last, to the Rats Castle, a late arrival on the toll house scene, and that was to make sure that people who were trying to avoid it still had to pay. And there was another turnpike at the what is now the Crown Public House, just before people go up to the railway. And we know that people who took their goods along Camp Road, which was a lesser known route, tried to avoid that toll by going across private land to what is now called Victoria Street via a back way. And that's how that lane, we presume, became more important over a period of time. Some people still know Victoria Street as Sweetbriar Lane. It hasn't had that name for probably 100 years, but people still call it that.
So we get this picture, there's constantly people trying to get round the system.
As we always do.
The book is too full of many things that you, and you do it in an interesting way, because you do it by the sort of, by, you could look at it by the year, you could look at it by the area, you look at it by the subject matter, and there's almost too many to pick one or two from. Is there anything that has struck you? I mean, we've talked about Fleetville as a whole, but is there anything within that you think is really a most interesting and something you were really surprised by? I mean, I noticed Clouds Park because I used to live near there, so I know quite a bit about that one. But there are milestones that you refer to. There are, are the milestones an important element in the story?
Well, they were. Probably not now we have cars. But the milestones only came about through a government edict. The turnpike roads were already in existence. But there came a point when the government suddenly decided that every turnpike should have a milepost. And I know we've talked about the turnpikes before, but it is interesting the fact that all the turnpike mileposts on the east side of St Albans, from when they were first installed until today, still exist. Only one of them not precisely in their exact locations. Only one of those still exists on the other side of St Albans, going towards Watford, Rickmansworth, out towards Reading. And that's the one on St Stephen's Hill. And most people have probably not stopped to have a look at it closely, but it's clearly on the wrong side of the road, because as you face away from St Albans, it gives you the mileage to St Albans. And that would actually make sense, because those on the east side of St Albans are all on the north side of the road. So it's presumed that the one remaining one on the south side, the one on St Albans Hill, would have been on the other side of the road, But for those who know St. Alban, St. Stephen's Hill, know that the other side of the hill is really quite cliff-like. So maybe there was a reason why, having cast it, it wasn't placed in that position.
Yeah. Mike, I'm ever so sorry we've run out of time, because you're going to have to come back next year and tell us a lot. Or you're going to have to read the whole book onto tape so we can send it, distribute it to our listeners as an audio book.
One of these days that might be possible.
Thank you very much for coming in. And I'm glad that your book is in the libraries. I'm glad that people are borrowing it so extensively. And I've seen it in bookshops myself as well. So thank you very much, Mike Naber.
You're welcome.